but I had to cover this kid up. I couldn't, all these bystanders were staring at this child, and I just couldn't take it.
Wow, we did not see that one coming.
What I don't get was, why wasn't she in the car, and where the hell did she go in the interim?
Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. I'm your host, Jim Clementi, with my co-host, Francie Hakes.
Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Francie?
Good.
It's good to be back, especially because we have Bob Ruff with us from Truth and Justice Podcast. How you doing, Bob?
Doing really well. How are you guys doing today?
Great.
Good. Thanks, Bob. Thanks for joining us again on Best Case, Worst Case.
My pleasure.
So today, Bob, we would like to have you talk about a worst case in your career, something that has really gotten under your skin or stuck with you for many years. Do you have a case like that?
Yeah, there's a case that's immediately comes to mind. As a matter of fact, you know, you and I, Jim, talked about your plans to make this podcast months ago, and I still remember sitting and you telling me that people will talk about their best case and their worst case, and then immediately this particular case came to mind.
Yeah. Well, what kind of case is it?
Well, it's not a long story, and it's not anything complicated. It involves the death of a child, which I've dealt with many times throughout my career. Mm-hmm. You know, in the fire service, we do EMS work as well. So, you know, death and things like that are just stuff that we have to deal with on a daily basis. It was just this particular case, and it comes back to last time I was on the show when I was talking about my best case. You know, the differences between what I did in my career in the fire service as opposed to you know, detectives or, you know, FBI agents that are looking into cases is when my stories start while the tragedy is still in progress.
Real active situation.
Right.
Things are happening. And it's interesting you bring that up. We talked to Joanne about when she responded to a very critical situation.
With a child.
With a mm-hmm. child, yes, actually multiple children. And in that case, she said she felt like time slowed down. Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, I listened to her describing that, and I guess similar. I think everybody has their own way of handling those situations.
Sure.
For me, I wouldn't describe what I would go through in the same manner that she would, but definitely things would slow down. And for me, it just becomes hyper-focus and just mm-hmm. it's immediately trying to just gather information from a chaotic scene and make a plan, because also in my position, I had 30 other guys looking to me saying, boss, what do we do next?
You know, I think, Bob, that's kind of what Joanne was describing. I mean, she described it as time slowing down, but mm-hmm. obviously time didn't slow down. It was her perceptions that were generated because of that rush of adrenaline, which of course firefighters even more so, I think, than detectives. Maybe beat cops are different, but firefighters more so than detectives have to be able to control that rush of adrenaline, that heightened senses, because you have to work, you have to act, you have to try to save lives.
Right. And actually part of exactly all of this we were just talking about is kind of what makes this or made this my worst case is I've always been just naturally good at that. In high stress, chaotic situations, I've always been able to be the guy to keep my cool and to continue to analyze and make plans and give orders and work. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, it's the one time I can say in my entire career that I remember just completely losing control. I was yeah. not good at my job that night.
Well, tell us how the case or the incident came into you. Where were you and what happened?
So as usual, I was at the fire station, just like the, in my best case, again, it was a night where it was just me. In this particular case, I wasn't in bed yet. It was 10:30 at night or so, maybe 11. I think I was just sitting in the day room watching TV and tones drop and we get a call for a single vehicle, or what they say, a two vehicle PI accident it came into, which PI means personal injury accident. So that means that there was two cars that crashed and someone's hurt. That's what they called us for.
So Bob, if that's coming into the fire station, I assume that means, as you implied earlier, that you also had EMS training.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and in this particular, I've worked at several different fire departments in different capacities. So at this department, which was my full-time department, we didn't do active EMS work, but we did basic first aid stuff to help with the ambulance, and that was just due to our low staffing levels. But I was EMT trained, so I would render care whenever I could. So this sounds like in that particular district where I was working at that time, PI accidents were a regular occurrence. I mean, you could count on, if you're in a week's tour, you were going to go 2, 3, 4 injury accidents. No big deal. So I jump in the truck, roll out, it was just right around the corner from the station. I just had to make two turns. And when I made the second turn, now mind you, one thing that we're taught to do is to review the dispatch information so you can start to kind of have a plan before you get to the scene. So I'm doing that. I've got two cars. It's going to be right there. It's going to be in front of the liquor store right there. It's going to be just past the light. And I'm thinking about what am I going to do with traffic and all this. Mm-hmm. So I turn the corner, and rather than seeing two cars, what I see laying in the middle of the road is a child. Oh, and it was, I still specifically remember turning the corner and seeing what I thought was like a big duffel bag. And I continued up and looked, and I still remember verbally saying, "Oh my God," because the kid looked like my son Quentin. I mean, it was like the same size, same blonde hair. It just for some reason, and that's never ever happened to me before. Every case that I've worked, that's never happened to me before.
That must have been a terrible moment.
Yeah, for some reason, I saw that kid and I saw my kid, and it was just like, take a breath. You got to get out and do your job. So, and I did. I set the parking brake on the truck. I notified dispatch, I'm on the scene. What do we have? Tell them I've got a kid in the road. And so now this is where being called in the middle of the tragedy comes into play. And where, like I said, I've said before, it takes a certain type of person. It's not that it's any good, one person's better than the other. It's just a particular skill set that I think is ingrained in certain people to be able to take chaos and make sense out of it. Well, this was about the most chaotic scene that I've ever arrived on in my life.
And what made it chaotic, Bob?
Well, for starters, the dispatch information was incorrect. So I'm showing up looking for two vehicles, and instead, all I see is a child in the road. And there's bystanders everywhere because there's a restaurant right there. And it's and this comes into play later, happens to be the one 24-hour restaurant in town, which is where everybody goes when the bars close. And this was a Friday night. Hmm. So
what
I get
time
out
of night?
Pardon me?
Time of night, was it?
It was right around 11 o'clock when the call came in. So I turn the corner and I see that. I get out of the truck and I start to approach. And as soon as I get out, there's a horn blaring that just won't stop. And that happens often in car accidents. The horn will get stuck in front on head on collisions. Well, and so of course that draws me, and I see there's a black car that had hit, gone off the road and hit like a telephone pole, and their horn was blaring. Mm-hmm. So they're 30 feet past where the child is, and then off the side of the road. And so I'm looking for where's the second vehicle, the horn. If either of you ever tried to focus on something when there's a loud noise happening at the same time,
yeah, there are definitely times when that really is an amazing distraction. You cannot focus no matter how much you try.
It's incredible. I've never had that. I mean, it's happened to me before where it bothers me, but in this scene, it was like, so I'm looking for two cars. Instead, I got a kid that looks like my kid in the middle of the road. I got a car over there with the horn blaring, and then I look up, and there's another person laying in the road 50 feet past him, an adult laying in the road. So, and then I've got a bunch of bystanders running around trying to yell things at me to tell me what's going on. There's too many of them talking all at once. Along with the horns, I got dispatch calling me on the radio, asking me what I need. My firefighters are starting to show up and ask me what to do. So all this happened at once. And so far, I'm holding it together. So I go, first patient, very much like your last case you had on there where it was airway, breathing, circulation. Go to the kid. And I hold the kid, and I don't want to get into gory details, but he was clearly should have been deceased at that time, but there were still nervous reactions that happened within the body that were causing what we call agonal respirations. And I know, as a medically trained firefighter and with my years on the job, this one is a lost cause. So what we're taught to do, separate emotions, move on, move to the next patient.
It's like the old MASH unit, the MASH TV show, where you have to triage people, and if there's nothing that can be done for them, no matter how serious it is or whether they're still alive, you move on to the people you can save. That must be an agonizing decision, Bob. How old approximately was this child?
The kid was 10 years old, but he was really small for his age. He looked much closer to about 6 years old, but he was about 10 because my son was about 6 at the time. And and that's what you have to do. You have to, and I've had to make that decision so many. I've been in fires and came across, you know, dead bodies in a fire and had to move on. I've mass casualty incidents where you got to make those. I've always been able to do that. For some reason, as long as this kid was still breathing, which he wasn't really breathing, it was these. I mean, and like I said, without getting into it, it's very obvious this child was deceased. Could not let go of him. I had him in my arms. And I could hear the person up ahead of me, the other person, he's screaming out in pain. He's an adult. So I should have left the kid, went to the adult. Well, look, one of my firefighters shows up. He runs over to go deal with the other guy. And once this kid finally stops making the agonal respirations, I lay him down, and the ambulance had just started to show up. And I go to them, and I'm said, give me a blanket, give me a sheet, because there's people everywhere. And there's just something in my mind that I had to cover this kid up. I couldn't, all these bystanders were staring at this child, and I just couldn't take it. And so when I'm supposed to be running the scene and telling people what to do and keeping control of everything, I'm perseverating on this blanket to cover the kid up instead of doing my job. And mind you, still, now there's more people asking me what to do. The horn's still blaring, and I'm still trying to figure out where the hell the second car is. You know, so it's just a mess. So then they give me a blanket. I throw a blanket over a sheet over the kid to cover him up, and I try to get my wits about me. And then I go over to the other patient who's a little bit further away from him, and I get about the guy's leg is just snapped in half, and he's got some blood on him, but he's conscious and he's screaming, and I get 10 feet away from him and can just smell the alcohol coming off of him.
Oh, really?
And I flipped. I mean, I didn't completely flip, I guess, but for me, flipped. Refused to treat him. I had two of my guys working him, and they're calling me over for help. And my exact words, and if you have to bleep this, you can. My exact words were, fuck him.
Because you know he's responsible for the dead child in the middle of the street.
Right, yeah. And it just, and I've never, ever, ever, before or after, lost it like that. But I came back, and then I'm I go to the car, the horn's still blaring. So there's still all this. I'm still trying to do my job, but I'm not dealing with that guy. And then people were asking me questions. At one point, I grabbed my helmet and threw it into the fire truck. I just completely lost my, I lost it. So then I try to re-engage and get back and figure out. I start asking questions now. I'm starting to get my wits. And mind you, everything I just described to you happened in 90 seconds.
Yeah. And that's the thing. When we talk to Joanne, it's the density of memory that actually makes things seem like they slow down. There's so many acute points and nuanced points that are just forever burned into your memory. And that's why it seems like it takes so much longer for it to happen. But I'd really like to find out, because the way you described it, I'm still very confused about what happened,
right,
to who, to where, from when. So if we could just talk a little bit about what actually happened, what physically happened at this point.
Yeah, so at this point, I said I've gone through, like, I'm battling what I always say, the heart-brain battle, right? So my heart's telling me just flipping out, and my brain's telling me, get back in the game. You've got work to do.
Right.
And so I'm kind of bouncing. So then I get back, you know, the brain side of me kind of takes control again. All right, let me go figure this out. I'll get to this car. And I'm still I don't scream at people. I don't yell at people. I was known for being calm and collected on an emergency scene.
You mean the opposite of me?
Yeah. Well, I've never been on an emergency scene with you, but I can imagine.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Well, yeah, an emergency scene. Obviously, things are different, but just passionate scene. Mm-hmm. I can be a little vocal, I've been told.
That is one way to put it, Jim.
And for me, I was just always very, I would teach this when I taught incident management. I would teach that, you know, if you're driving with the pedal on the floor all day long, when you really need to gun it, there's nothing left. Like, keep it, you know, leave something in the tank as far as screaming at people and losing your mind. Well, in that morning or that night, I get into the car and I'm trying to shut the car off because this car is still running. And that's something I should have done when I got there, was secure the car, make sure it's in park and it's off. That horn's still blaring. I shut it off. The horn won't stop. People are talking in my ear. I remember grabbing one of my young firemen and just screaming at him, just get that fucking horn shut off, cut the battery out, whatever you like. So I had my guys with extrication tools ripping this hood apart to cut the battery cable so the horn would shut off, because I couldn't take the horn for some reason that morning or that night.
Sounds like the horn was basically a sort of an overarching symptom of what you were experiencing, just that terrible first few moments of seeing the child in the road and associating it to your own and the child dying in your arms. I mean, Bob, this is awful.
Yeah, and it was just sensory overload completely. So then the horn's off and I'm looking through the car. And one of the deputies got in with me and we're looking around. I'm like, so now what we're thinking, Jim, because there's also in the car, in the windshield, right in front of the driver's seat, there's a huge hole. So the thought is the guy was driving and hit something, hit that pole and got ejected, but nothing was adding up. So we're trying to figure this out. And we didn't know if the kid was in the car, if they hit the kid. Why was the kid in the middle of the road at 11 o'clock at night? And this is a 4-lane highway. Not a divided highway, 55 mile an hour speed limit. And then the deputy says, Bob, we got a problem. And he holds up and he's got like a purse and a makeup bag in the passenger seat.
Oh, and my gosh.
Like, she's like, we got a car. We got a man and a boy and a person makeup. Where's the girl? And we're like, oh, my God. And I'm still looking for the second car. And it was right about that time I hear screaming and shrieking. And I look up and this woman comes running across the street looking at the boy, which is now a white blanket that's soaked in blood, screaming. And I grab her and she just latches onto me. So I'm just hugging this woman in the middle of the street as she's screaming. And it takes me a few minutes to get out of her. She was the driver of the car. And she's just, this is my fault. So I'm trying to, in that moment, got myself together enough to calm her down and tell her this is not your fault. This is like, let's just calm down. Let's talk. And then she tells me, she's saying it was dark. I couldn't see anything. I don't know what happened. And finally I asked, were either of them in the car with you? And she said, no, they ran across the street in front of me.
Wow. We did not see that one coming.
And wait, she was the driver of the car that hit the pole?
So this is ultimately what happened. She is driving on the road as normal. That particular part of this road has no lights, no street lights. And she's cruising along 55 miles an hour, and this guy, this drunk guy, and this 10-year-old boy go running across the street in front of them, and she hits them both. The boy was hit the shorter and more vital areas and skidded for a long way after she hit him. The adult, the man, the drunk guy that was taking the kid across the street to the liquor store at 11 o'clock at night actually went over the hood into the windshield. That was the hole in the windshield. And she started to hit the brakes. He flew out, and somehow she ended up over by that telephone pole. When it was over with, she just drove over to it, hit the pole. But the damage to the hood wasn't actually from the pole. It was from the adult's body hitting her car.
But what I don't get was, why wasn't she in the car, and where the hell did she go in the interim?
She ran to you. She couldn't find her phone. That's why her purse was there. She said she was freaking out, started digging for her phone, couldn't find it, and then took off running to find some place to use a phone. So there was a grocery store across the street.
So she was going to try to call 911.
Right. And so she did actually get through to 911 and then came back and saw, she was a little unclear about what had happened. She just said she just saw two people. There was impact. This guy's face was through her windshield right in front of her, and then he was gone, and she just took off. So that's the mechanics of what had actually happened. There never was a second vehicle. It was just the one vehicle and the two guys. So then, as this goes on, so once things start to calm down, they're heated. These drunk people start getting, as the night goes along, we have to leave the little boy's body in the road until the accident investigators get there so they can reconstruct the scene. So this is hours and hours and hours. And by 2-3 in the morning, the drunks all come out of the restaurant there. And, I still remember there was a guy using his phone. There's still flip phones then when they first started putting cameras in them. Was trying to take pictures of the boy's body when we were trying to put it into a body bag.
Oh, Bob, you've got to be kidding me.
No, and I slapped his phone down the street where I got ran over by a car. He actually called my chief about that a couple days later. There was almost a physical altercation. I mean, this is the whole night, emotions were high like that.
I hope your chief said you did the right thing and not the wrong thing.
Yeah. He my chief was a good guy. He knew that I was pretty tore up about the whole thing. Because, you have that, and I'm sure, at least, Jim, you've experienced probably this. There's a moment when a parent gets notified, and I actually have tears that are welling up right now thinking about it. When a parent gets told that their child is dead, and a mother specifically, there's a scream that all of them have, and that woman screamed that night when she got there and was told that her 10-year-old boy was gone. It just pierces right through you, and
you can never forget that yourself.
No. And it was, and everybody on the scene knew that. And I worked with a great group of guys that just, another lieutenant from another station kind of helped take over things on the scene for me and give me a breather. And, the next day, I was divorced, and my son was with my ex-wife, and I remember calling her the next day, just telling her, I just need to see my kid.
Yeah.
That's such an understandable reaction. Yeah. Bob, do you think that the reason you had this visceral, instant, right-on-the-scene reaction was because of the child's resemblance to your son, or do you think it was just, it was a child?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm like, right now, I'm sure you can hear, I'm kind of wiping tears away now thinking back on it. And I don't know. I've dealt with many dead children in my career. And, you know, and they're, everyone's horrible, but I honestly don't know, other than that second, that moment, because I still remember specifically that moment, turning the engine. I turned off Bell Road and turned right on South 11th Street, and the first thing I saw was a duffel bag that turned out to be a kid that looked exactly like mine.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that did it or what, but it is stuck with me for going on 15 years now.
Bob, it sounds to me like there was a trigger that pierced your clinical detachment. That's something that we as professionals develop over our careers, because we have exposure to so much, you know, death and destruction, that in order to actually see past that emotion and actually do our jobs, and that is saving lives and collecting evidence and interpreting evidence and solving crimes or accidents, that is something that's protective for us. It sounds to me like in this one instance that was pierced and you no longer had that detachment and you felt it, as Francie said, very viscerally.
Yeah, that's, you know, I've never had it explained to me like that, but that's, I think you're exactly right, because that's, we do have that clinical detachment and all these other cases, but yeah, something about that one, it just went right. And then it makes me think that, you know, the respect I have for all police officers and firemen and firefighters, anybody, emergency service workers of any kind, that you realize how hard it is for a normal person to stop, to put that block up in order to do your job.
Well, and I'm just brought back to a case that I remember where a similar thing happened to me. And that was after I actually was out because I had a bone marrow transplant, and the very first case when I came back, which is a worst case that I won't talk about in detail, but what happened when I was in that consult and when we were going through the facts was that I really felt viscerally what happened to this victim. I'd been so close to death recently, and I wasn't that strong when I had come back, and I just felt it all, and I felt I just couldn't do it. I couldn't actually see past the emotion of it, and I literally, it's the only time in my career where I got up and I said, I can't do this right now. And what I decided to do was go teach at the FBI Academy for 6 months until I could sort of get my clinical detachment back and actually do the right thing and be able to interpret the cases and the behavior.
Well, it's impressive that you recognize that in yourself and took care of it.
Well, it is. And, you know, for me, I think if I had to assess myself as a prosecutor, I did not have that clinical detachment, which most prosecutors will tell you is necessary to have so that you don't become overly emotionally involved with the victims, the cases, the issues. I was never quite able to get that distance. And I'm reminded, like Jim, of a child homicide case that I had in Albany, Georgia. And a mother's boyfriend had been watching her twin sons. They were 12 months old. He had been watching her twin sons while she was at work. And one of them had been sick with like a cold and was very coughy and sick. It was apparently quite disruptive. The child was constantly coughing and had to be taken care of. And they were supposed to be down for a nap, was his story later. Well, to make what was a terribly long story short, he took the child who was sick and slammed him against a doorframe, cracking his skull and severely injuring his brain and killing him. And one of the things I've never forgotten about that case is having to go over the autopsy photos with the medical examiner and becoming so emotional myself, looking at this beautiful little boy just prior to the autopsy, lying on that cold steel table, looking like he was asleep, knowing that he wasn't, that he had a twin who would have to grow up alone. And then when we tried the case, trying to pull myself together enough to give a closing argument without crying myself. And I consider myself an emotional person. So that was a challenge for me to give this passionate, emotional closing argument to convince a jury to convict him without getting emotional myself. And I'll never forget sitting down at the end of my closing argument and having an immediate blinding headache just because of all the stress that I felt making sure that I put the right case up, that I got this guy convicted. And Bob, you're so right. It was almost instantaneous. The moment I got that case and saw that photograph of that child on that cold steel table, it was very hard to think, and it was very hard to put a case together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, Francie, I can totally relate to that, and I understand completely. I know that the case that pushed me beyond wanting to be a prosecutor anymore was a case where there was no justice for a child victim. And it's the hardest thing in the world because when you're a prosecutor, you have to develop a relationship with your witnesses and your victims. And that relationship can help them through the process, but it can also drag them through a process that might ultimately lead to a lot of very negative experiences and injustice. And so that really got to me as well. And maybe one day we can talk a little bit more about those cases.
I should say, because I'm sure people are wondering, that offender was convicted, by the way, and got a life sentence.
Well, that's
so
good.
Yeah. I did do my job, but it was really hard.
Well, and that's what this podcast is all about. It not only brings our listeners behind police lines, it also gives them insights into what police and firefighters and investigators and prosecutors, what they experience, what it's like to constantly have to deal with the things that typically the general public is held off. They don't have to experience that. They're sort of a buffer, and that buffer is law enforcement and the justice system.
Yeah, so Bob, last question, I think, or from me anyway. The prosecutor in me can't help but wonder whether or not the woman driving the car was drunk, and were there any charges brought in your worst case?
She was not drunk, and she really, I felt terrible for the woman because she really had done nothing wrong. I mean, and as everything, when we talked to other witnesses, when the whole thing was over with, when we were doing our report, people that happened to be outside the restaurant or whatever, they all said the same thing, that this guy was holding this kid's hand and they just darted and sprinted across the street. And they were, and when we talked to the mother, the drunk boyfriend was going to make a run to the liquor store to get him some more booze for the night. And for some reason decided to take the 10-year-old kid with him. So,
And was he prosecuted? I mean, he obviously put that child in danger. He actually was responsible, right?
I believe 100% that he was responsible. I do not have the answer to whether or not he was ever prosecuted. I'm actually not sure about that.
Well, I have to say the answer is probably no, because, Bob, as a first responder, you would have been called to testify if there had been any
right.
sort of a trial, or at least interviewed for a statement. So I bet he wasn't prosecuted.
Yeah, no, and no one from the DA's office ever asked for my report or anything, so I would assume no.
Mm.
Terrible, and just like Jim said, injustice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bob, it's been, again, very revealing, very interesting talking to you about your worst case, and I would like to ask you if you'd be willing to come back maybe again and talk to us about a best case and worst case in your second career, your sort of crowdsourced investigation and exoneration career?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do that.
Great. Well, we'd definitely love to have you. And again, I've said this before on my podcast and on yours, that I'm really so thankful, grateful that you have taken on this role of sort of organizing an army of people across the country and even around the world that are very, very concerned about justice. And you're bringing justice to people who've suffered without it for many, many years.
Well, thank you for that. And as always, I really appreciate all the, you've been a real mentor along the way too, and helping me learn how to make the shift from being a fire investigator to investigating these wrongful convictions. I, as you know, I pick your brain as often as you'll let me.
Well, now you have another brain to pick. Francie's here, and she's That's ready, right. willing, and able, especially if you continue to describe the wardrobe of firefighters when they get up in the morning.
That's right. And I think people are going to have to tune in for your best case to understand
and what, that
what
means.
It is Jim is talking about. Yeah. But I do want to say that when I hear, as you bring up in your podcast often, Bob, about things that prosecutors have missed. I mean, prosecutors are supposed to be that last line for justice between an incident and a conviction. And when they're not doing their job, or when they're doing a poor job, or when they're doing a corrupt job, I'm glad you're there to point that out, and I'm certainly there to assist as needed.
Awesome. I'm sure that's a resource we will definitely be using in the future.
Thank you again, Bob Ruff, for coming from Truth and Justice Podcast and talking to us about your worst case today. And we really look forward to having you on again. And for now, we're signing off from Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production, produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Terrell Parham, music by Simba Sumba, and hosted by Wondery.